From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to a full hour of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. This is Cade Massey hosting this week with two of my three fellow co-hosts, Eric Bradlow and Audie Weiner, are both here. Shane Jensen out doing Shane Jensen things this week. He'll be back. Some combination of us are here almost every week of the year, have been for 10 years. We're going to call this the first show of the next 10 years. Last week, we ran a special reviewing, reflecting on the last 10 years, and this week we'll start the next 10. Appreciate y'all being with us. We're going to go two open segment lines this week. No guest segment this week. We're going to visit with Audie Weiner from Florida. He's down doing spring training kind of things, getting some firsthand reportage off of baseball. So we'll spend the first half of the show debriefing with Audie, catching up with Audie. We haven't been collectively on the same place in a few weeks now. And then after the break, we'll come back and do a round robin, a number of interesting storylines emerging in a few different sports. That's what we roughly have in tap on tap for the next hour. So Eric, Audie, let's go with Audie first. Odd from Florida. It's Audie, man, right now in the Northeast, it's exactly what you think the March is going to be like and what you're done with and tired of. And you think it's warm outside and it's not warm. And then you talk to your friends down in the South or visiting the South like you, and it makes us mad, but all the same, let's hear how it is. Tell us what's going on down there. You took in a little baseball yesterday.
I sure did take in a bit of baseball yesterday. I was, in the part of Florida that I'm in is the southern eastern part, where if I remember as a kid, and Eric, you'll correct me, all the teams played down here. We're down to only five teams that are playing in the southern southeastern part of Florida. You have in Jupiter, which is where I was, which is north of Palm Beach. You have the Marlins and the Cardinals. You have in Port St. Lucie, the Mets, and you have the Washington Nationals sharing a stadium with the Houston Astros in West Palm Beach. That's it, five teams. Now, it works out for me because for many years, we had Penn grads at the Nationals and Mets. We still do. But we also have an incredible locus of Penn grads at the Marlins. So I was able to go to the Marlins Stadium in Jupiter and hang out with our former students. And it was just a lot of fun to watch the Marlins, who had brought their full lineup. They're basically opening day lineup we're playing.
Before we talk about baseball players, give us the lineup of the at least some of the Wharton alums who are involved.
And what their roles are.
And their roles are. So, of course, Sam Mondry-Cohen, who's probably my first sports analytics student. He has a great story, which has been all over about. In fact, it was in some sense, he's the impetus for me to really get in this. He walked into my office about 15 years ago and said, I'd like to learn baseball analytics with you. And I said, well, what do you know about statistics? And he said, nothing. And I said, well, go back around and go take a class in statistics. And he signed up for my class. And towards the end of that class, he started having a weekly office hour with me, just the two of us. And then I had the regular office hour right after that. And that became an office hour that other students were part of later on. And they did that with me. And then it became a seminar. And then, you know, Wasabi kind of popped out. So it's in some sense, you go back to Sam Mondry-Cohen, and that's where it begins. He was an assistant general manager at the Nationals when they won the World Series. And now he's a vice president of scouting and evaluation for the Miami Marlins. So I met with Sam initially. But our other students are there who have been there longer. Jennifer Brand, she was a part of she was a softball player at Penn and part of my seminar and a Wharton Moneyball Academy TA. She is traveling with the team. She does statistics to prepare for every game. She's in the clubhouse. She works with the players. I talked to her. She shags fly balls with the team before the game to establish credibility.
I think I would write that in my contract. If I worked for a major league team, I would have the right to shag fly balls. There's very little I enjoy more than shagging fly balls.
I agree. That's a great activity. I will say I've heard this from some of my other students who were with teams that it helps to establish a little credibility with the players and coaches that you can play a little. Nobody expects you to be, you know, world class or even nearly at their level. But the idea that you can get out there and throw the ball relatively hard and catch a fly ball matters to them in some way that we can, you know, it's a managerial thing you could probably enlighten us on. So Jennifer was there.
Let me give an example of that. One of the first NFL games I attended for a team that it was, well, it doesn't matter much. It was the Redskins, but I was on the sideline before the game. This was many years ago, and a ball came my way just in the pregame stuff. And I just picked it up and threw it back. But the guy I was with paid a lot of attention to how I threw the ball. I was surprised that he cared at all. He's like, he really watched how I threw that ball.
It's interesting because Robbie Knopf is another. He graduated Penn in 2017. He's a senior analyst with the Marlins, and he said on a scale of 1 to 10, they asked him in an interview, "How well can you play baseball?" And he said, "Is there anything lower than one?" So he represents completely the other side of the kind of athleticism baseball side, knows the game inside and out, but not as a player. So both of them were there. They have to go, of course, work. They have projects and stuff to do. So I sat with them for a while. But what was really great was that Sam came out. We talked, we watched the game together. Also, one of the owners of the Marlins was there, David Ott, who's a longtime, he was a track and field star at Penn, and his wife, are big contributors to the athletic department, and he's really interested in being a part of the active ownership at the Marlins. And he watched the entire game with me down by with some other scouts who are in the scouting section.
Real quickly on that, what do you know and what can you tell us about how ownership works in Major League Baseball right now? So this is a growing issue across sports, this chance for outside investors to get in. Historically in North American sports, it was even in some sports prohibited. And increasingly they're allowing people to come in as passive investors, small owners. Different leagues have different rules about this. What's the story right now in baseball? To the extent that you know, at the very least, what is Ott's role with the Marlins? What level of ownership? What role is he playing there as an owner?
Well, I don't believe he's like the managing partner, so he doesn't. He's not at the level of making the decisions, and I don't know how it actually works there. So I shouldn't say anything with any authority because I essentially have no understanding. But he's there. He's there for a few weeks. He sits around. He's in the dugout. He's in the back of the stadium talking to people. So in some level, he probably has influence. I know that he talks to Sam regularly, and they discuss what's going on and what they're thinking about. I had a great time talking to him for at least an hour before the game, just talking about analytics, what we're doing at Wasabi, what the Marlins are doing, what the big questions in baseball. He was just picking my brain. He's a very accomplished business person, used analytics and in his success. And I think that's what's great. I think the organization structure at the Marlins is excellent. So that's something that's terrific.
Do you get some sense about how impactful or the kinds of decisions? Because as you said, you've put a lot of students at the Marlins. Do you get the sense that it's, well, clearly there's, let's assume, some on-field stuff. Let's assume it's got some effect on scouting, but let's just go through the list. On-field, scouting, training, player contracts, the business side. Do you get a sense that analytics is in all of those?
Okay, so my recollection from the Marlins before Sam got there was it was a very small shop in terms of analytics. They had, you know, Robbie's been there. Jennifer was hired, I think, 2021. But if you had to rank baseball teams from 1 to 30, I don't know exactly where I put the Marlins in terms of the size, which are relatively public pieces of information. Definitely bottom, certainly bottom quartile, maybe even bottom quintile. So not certainly not one of the big teams in terms of their investments, which of course are the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Rays, which is a small market team. They spend an incredible number on amount of money on analytics. The Cleveland Indians are not the Indians, the Guardians now. So that's the top tier, and the Marlins have always been on the bottom, and they're really trying to change that. So I think they're budgeting. One of the things I think that Sam's going to be working on is really growing their analytics at all aspects of the game. One of the things that Jennifer told me she does during the game is watching their pitchers to make sure they don't have tells, which I know this is going on because it's happened in playoff games. So you got to take countermeasures. You got to look for tells in your own pitchers to make sure they're not doing it.
Adi, do you think there's a time where a real live AI engine could actually watch the pitcher, come up with a prediction of what pitch, they're going to throw and see how highly predictive it is. Because if an AI engine could assess a tell, then, I'm just saying, to me, that seems like a very easy application, actually, of a supervised learning problem where you know what the pitches are. You could see the pitcher's grip or the windup or the body angle or something. It seems like this is actually something that you could do using just modern data science.
I would agree. I think that's a great potential possibility. We just look at the video, extract features, or have the machine,
Right.
the AI extract features, correlate them with what pitches it's thrown, and see what shows up. I mean, this is great application. Right now, they're doing it the old-fashioned way. You're just watching them as they do it.
Let me push you on sample size needed for some. What's your intuition for sample size needed for something that is not something you can borrow strength for across pitchers, because we're looking for very idiosyncratic styles, techniques, and tells. So you're going to have reps on a guy. You probably need real game reps on a guy. How many of those do you need for a model like that, which is going to use, zillions of features to reliably predict something like that?
I'm going to just give an opinion first. I think you can borrow some strength across players because there may be some common patterns. I think also you'd have to do some feature engineering, which means you probably can't jam in a million features because in theory you could measure a million features, but you probably can't use them all. But yeah, my guess would be, if someone throws 100 pitches, maybe you could watch their warm up, maybe you could watch other things in the point of a season. Could you see a pitcher throw a couple thousand pitches, which might allow you to do so something? I think that's possible, but that's my opinion. But I'd love Adi's. You'd have to do dimension
Well,
reduction first.
before you go,
all the
let me respond to that real quick because it feels, again, I'm going to play, my instinct goes this way, but let me also just play the devil's advocate. When someone's, I'm guessing, I've never sat and tried to figure out tells on a pitcher, but I'm guessing that you're considering an almost infinite number of dimensions when you're trying to figure out tells. And so I feel like it's a bad space to need to do dimension reduction, this feature engineering, and only work with a few sets of inputs, precisely because you're looking for anything that might tell.
could be. Could be. It could also be, by the way, this is also something you've talked about in football and other sports, Cade. It could be this is the kind of thing where you combine automated feature with scouting information. So maybe there's not enough information in the automated extracted features, but if I combine that with Jennifer sitting there, who's also scoring this, then all of a sudden maybe I have something.
It's a really tough problem, and because there are so many possible features, see, I would imagine you'd have to get some sort of feature reduction, dimensionality reduction
As I said,
history.
yeah.
These are the kinds of things that people have tipped off, and this is the ways they've done it. But being an effect size guy, right, Eric, the key idea is you're looking for a feature that's a tell, that's a nearly 100% shot, right? So you're looking for things that have a real signal. Something that's slightly predictive is not going to be useful. It's got to be something that's a total tip-off. When you look straight at third base when there's a runner on first, or look at whatever it is, and then you turn your head. These are the kinds of tells that have been destructive to pitchers, and those are the things you want to catch. If it's not 100%, it's not really a tell,
I
right?
think, but aren't you implying that because tells are such big effects, when they exist, they'll be much easier to detect? We're not,
That's
we're
right.
so, in sports analytics, we're so often looking for these little bitty edges. And in this case, if you identify it, it's a big edge. And so therefore, you don't need as much power to find it.
You have a lot of power, but you don't need much data to
Right,
find the
right.
best of the best, right?
The effect of power. Right. Super interesting. One related question. How sophisticated are models in predicting pitches, which should be, it's more like a game state plus individual pitcher, maybe batter characteristics. I would think you could build a decent model for that. Is that?
Well, I know this is a subject of research. I know that we at Wasabi did a fellows project with the team exactly on this topic, predictability of pitchers. And there's a lot of questions related to how do you use forecastability, predictability, entropy of the pitcher to maybe become a better pitcher. And that's something that there certainly are proprietary models out there that teams use. And that's really what teams who have a lot of staff will work on, these kind of modelings. Teams that don't have it are really just going day to day. They're just sort of preparing for the game. One of the things I did get from the Marlins was the it's the staff that tells the outfielders where to stand. And I knew that's the case at teams, but she also said that there's Jennifer that they're good at it and the professionals know where to stand and they follow. They're out there in the position that they know what to do and they know per player where to be. And this has been a huge, I mean, as anyone who's watched baseball knows, yeah. And this, although they've changed the rules of the ship. I mean, there was a shot up the middle that was at 105 miles an hour, right to the second baseman.
You're right.
Standing on second base. And for me as an old baseball guy, I mean, what is this?
That's a hit,
right?
That's got to be a hit. You know what?
No, that's not a hit.
Yeah, Kate, something you said also struck a thought to me, which is the framework you've laid out also gives you stuff about the value of information. And what I mean by that is, let's imagine I could just use batter, pitcher, easily observable characteristics to predict the pitch. Now, you've asked an interesting question. Let's suppose I build this AI engine. What's the value of that additional information above just situational features and batter pitcher characteristics? What's the value of the scouting data above it? Maybe I can just predict, you know, curveball, slider, fastball, whatever, as a function of observables, like this is the pitcher's best pitches. This is the weakness of the batter. This is what happens on a 3-1 count. So this is all, I think what you're also saying is before one invests in data, this is what we tell our businesses all the time, what's the value of that information in improving the prediction above, I'll call it easily observable things. And it's not that obvious that you couldn't build a good predictive model without this million feature AI engine or even potentially a scout.
Super interesting. I love it when the guy who heads up analytics at Wharton plays the AI skeptical card or the AI unnecessary card. There's a time and place for it, and there's a time and place to be skeptical of it being oversold. Eric just talked about a good way of thinking about its potential use.
So,
we only have a few more minutes here. Give us some highlights or some favorite moments from that.
So one of the favorite moments was, of course, since the Marlins shared their stadium with the Cardinals, even though the Cardinals weren't playing. I had the opportunity to watch a good hour of the game with an old friend of mine, a former Red Sox GM, Chaim Bloom, who came down to the field and watched the game with us, just walked out of a meeting. He's now the special advisor to the Cardinals. And he was wonderful sharing what he's doing. Not the kind of thing I can talk about on the radio, but it's just a lot of fun. And just watching the game, there was a Pittsburgh Pirates scout standing, you know, sitting a few rows behind us. Just watching the game with these absolute, you know, immersive experts, statisticians, leaders. And it just was just great fun to just sit there and be part of that. So
I understand the fun part of it for sure. Mm-hmm. Anything in particular that they observed or they thought about, or you came away thinking differently after having sat with essentially a GM and a scout watching this spring ball?
Well, one of the things that we talked about, we sort of openly, was what is the future for baseball rules and what are the big issues and concerns is baseball having going forward? And they all hit repeatedly on the same point, the game's got to get more fun to watch for the new crowd. And they kept talking about ideas to make the game more quicker, which is, I think they made amazing strides last year with the pitch clock, but also to get fewer strikeouts and more balls in play. And I heard a strange idea that I, of course, am repulsed by being a conservative when it comes to the state of baseball, which is a bigger ball. And I'm like, what?
Oh my goodness.
Bigger ball? I was thinking that. You know, and of course, you know, one of the things we talked about is speed. The overall success rate in stolen bases last year was extremely high. I think it was around 80%. That's primarily because of the larger bases. We think that those 3 inches in total don't matter. They do. And also, of course, the pickoff move being limited. Only two.
What's your relative attribution to the pickoff move versus the size of the base? I just intuitively gave it all to the pickoff, not to the size of the base. I'm wrong about that.
My intuitive attribution is 50-50. Think about how many stolen bases get decided. The ones that are outs are often very close. So, you know, those 3 inches, that's not nothing. But I think I do think, obviously, the pickoff, you're looking at me like you're crazy. That it's
well,
gotta
I'm
be
thinking,
the
I'm just thinking about it. I'm thinking of it as, you know, it's 6 inches, 3 inches, 3 inches. But remember, it's 90 feet between the bases. So that's 1,080 inches. And so I'm thinking it's like one half of 1% of the total distance essentially that's been changed. That I would be surprised if that part has that large an effect when you look at it that way.
Now I'll give you another. What is the margin of error? What is the distance? When you're safe, by how much are you safe? And when you're out, by how much are you out? That's the thing to compare your 6 inches to. Is it? And I think it's less. So if you're out by a
That's
foot,
fair. Probably
then
most players that are out by, let's call it 2 feet or less. So now you've gained 6 inches out of 2 feet. It's not the first 88 feet don't matter. Anybody can get the first
No.
88 feet. It's the last two. That's a good
That's
day. I stand corrected. Good point.
and so that was fascinating. And one of the things that keeps coming up, I think, is that the historically stolen bases, they just don't add that much one way or the other. And one of the things that Chaim mentioned is that because the run environment is so oriented towards home runs and strikeouts, getting a runner from first to second doesn't have the value that it used to have, because there used to be singles that happened to drive you in, and this was more of an incremental sport where
Home run's going to
you
drive you in whether you're on first or second.
That was exactly what Chaim's point. And I think that this is something that is going to be worked on, because survey after survey says that one of the most exciting events in baseball is a stolen base. You want to see more of it. Whether it matters to the output or not, it's just plain fun. And at the end of the day, baseball, like every other sport, is entertainment.
Actually, just for 10 seconds, let me just add as a marketing professional, put on my hat, which Adi just brought up. I wonder how much survey-based research or talking to the customer, when you want to know what product to sell, ask the customer sometimes. I wonder if they've asked people, what's actually that exciting for you about baseball? Is it the stolen bases? Is it this? Is it that? So why not engineer something towards something having to do with insights drawn from the customer? That's all.
I want more action on the bases. I want more plays, throws to third as a runner tries to make it in there from whatever source. Okay, fellas, let's wrap that segment from that's Adi reporting spring training first person down in Jupiter, Florida, sitting with some execs on a couple different teams. Thanks for that update, Adi. He's going to stick around. We're going to have Adi in the second half as well. We have a number of topics we're going to talk about. Be back with Adi and Eric Bradlow after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to the second half of this week's show on sports analytics. We do this every week on SiriusXM. We're recording this week on Tuesday afternoon, as we typically do. The show will go up Wednesday morning, be replayed a few times on SiriusXM, and we'll get the podcast up on Wednesday morning as well. We usually have guests in the second half of the show, but in this week, we're just going to stay open lines. We haven't been around each other for a few weeks, so we thought we'd do that. Plus, we had Adi reporting, sort of like a guest, reporting from Jupiter, Florida on spring training down there. In the second half of the show, we want to collect a few different topics from around the world of sports. Let's start with, I think, the most obvious one this week, which is March Madness. It's here, finally. If you weren't paying attention to college basketball, you might pay attention to it beginning Thursday night, or maybe for the play-in games Tuesday night. We've got the brackets in front of us. We've got decisions. We've got lotteries. Gentlemen, anything interesting coming out of the seeds announced on Sunday? Anything interesting about the brackets as you see it? Any general strategies that are worth re-emphasizing this moment in time, this point in the calendar?
So I'll just jump in. Neil Payne had a nice article on his Substack where he just pointed to the statistical irregularities in the bracketing that are basically they seed, and they don't always seed by the strength of the teams, but by some other metric, and that always leads to a couple of very obvious upsets that aren't actually upsets that you should be picking. That's the if you're putting a get together a bracket and you want some advice, that's the first place to start. Make sure you know what those are.
Well, hold on. I missed what you said there about what Neil did, because Neil, I read it as well, but how did you characterize what the
So
mistake?
basically, a match where the seed doesn't reflect the underlying power scores.
Right. So, I mean, it's just the imperfection. They don't rank it as a quant would necessarily. Now, they've
That's
used
right.
models, but there may be disagreement. They're going to consider a lot of things. And what Neil does is he just uses straight power rankings and then runs a sim. And ask, given these power rankings, and here we go. Here's a very important factor in Neil's analysis, Adi, is the matchups. So the one complaint I would have to Neil, I love his article, but the one complaint I'd have with Neil he's showing the likelihood that any given seed advances to each round versus what the average seed at that number has advanced in the, historically. And so, for example, Auburn this year, a four seed in the East, is shown as 10% more likely to make the next round than historical four seeds, and 20% more likely to make the round of 32. So, or win the round of 32. So that's the kind of analysis he does. Of course, there are two factors there. One is the quality of that team versus historical teams with the same seed, but also the quality of the competition they face. Those are both in there. But you're right that it's a terrific heuristic for anybody who wants an edge on their bracket. Look at Neil Payne's Substack. He gives you lots of ideas on who's more or less likely to advance than teams with those seeds in the past.
Well, I think, as Adi said, I mean, this is also what I hate to say, but betting people do all the time also, right? So they compare, you know, on one axis, you might have the spread, and on the other axis, you might have something like win probability difference. And everyone's looking for those arbitrage opportunities where, you know, team X is favored over team Y by 7 points, but the win probability according to a strength model is 51-49, which no way implies a 7-point spread. My guess is that kind of simple analysis is the one that data-driven bettors probably use the most, right?
Agreed. And I mean, that's using the point spread per se. In these brackets, they don't have to use the point spread as much, right? If you're picking your brackets, one of the things that's hard to suss out without a sim is that some teams might have trouble with the early rounds, but then if they make it past that, then they have a good ramp after that, or flip it around. They might have easy for a couple, but then they're going to run into a lot of trouble. You only see that when you have something like a sim to work with. So, for example, Houston, one of the top seeds, a one seed in the South region, they have a little bit of a tough draw those first couple of rounds. But if they make it into the round of eight, they are much more likely to advance from the round of eight than one seeds who made it that far in the past. So there's some of this like non, I don't know, non-monotonicity in the draw, which is an interesting feature of the tournament.
I was just,
Yeah,
I
what
just
about
wanted the question I put in our rundown, which I think, Adi, you've looked at a little bit, is let's imagine I'm trying to fill out a bracket. Okay. Let's, for the moment, I know you've looked at multiple brackets, but let's just say I'm just going to fill out a single bracket for the moment. And I say to myself, okay, let me first hit the button that says pick all the chalk winners, the higher seed. So that bracket gets filled out. Now, the problem I know is that's not actually what's going to happen. Like all the 16 seeds are not going to necessarily, all the 16, 15, 14, all the lower seeds are not necessarily going to lose. How would you adjust? Like, how would you put enough upsets in there? Suppose I told you the marginal frequency of upsets. Like, here's how often the 9 beats the 8, the 10 beats the 7, etc. Like, how would you use that information? Would you just try to match the marginal frequencies of upsets? And then, of course, that would only help you say the number, wouldn't tell you who's going to upset who. But how would you use, I'll call it marginal upset frequency, to adjust your bracket from the, I'll call it the normative solution of pick the winner?
All right, well, I could probably spend an hour on the topic, so I'm going to try to be really, really brief and right to the point. The problem is that not all upsets are created equal. So picking a 16 over one is a giant upset, and picking, an 8 over a 9 over an 8, what the hell's that?
Well, remember,
Is
I'm
that
going to
in any
match the
case? Yeah.
marginal frequencies. I'm not going to be marginal as to 16s, 15s.
Right.
I'm going to know it by position.
Right. A better way to do it is to calculate the probability of a bracket according to your model. And if you do a little bit of math, which I'll skip, with very high probability, a winning bracket would be what we call a typical or within epsilon of the typical probability, which means that almost all the high probability brackets are atypical, and you shouldn't pick one. That means not enough, too much chalk. And you don't want to have too much upsets because those aren't going to win either. So there's a sweet spot, which is within epsilon, where epsilon, of course, is arbitrary, of the entropy of the tournament. And you want to pick as many brackets as you can from that sweet spot. Now, that's not a good choice if you're competing
Adi,
against, yeah.
the entropy of the tournament. I'm not going to try to
That's right.
pronounce it like you did, but the entropy of the tournament.
Yes.
Elaborate what that means exactly.
The entropy of the tournament basically is, there are 2 to the 63, I guess, or 2 to 64 possible, or 2 to 63, or the possible brackets that you could enter. And they're not all equally likely. So that is an absurdly large number. But the entropy basically says, what is the effective size of the set of all brackets that have that can win? Eliminating all the ones essentially that have no probability because there are too many upsets and the upsets are too extreme. There's another way to think about it, which actually gets rid of the high probability ones as well, not because they're not each individually high probability, because there are too few of them to matter. And then that leaves you the sweet spot, which is the set of all brackets that are roughly the same probability, and the cardinality of that, which is a fancy way of saying the size of that set, is the entropy of the tournament. And I believe it's something like, we actually calculated it in a paper.
What's the area of the space that's reasonable? Like, of all the potential space, the choice space for a bracket, which is so big, what percentage of that is reasonable? And is this interesting?
Yes, the percentage of it's essentially nearly zero. Most of the bracket. So I can cut it down by a factor of over a trillion and still be. I mean, because there's 2 to the 5th, 2 to the 63 brackets. So yeah, the set of all possible brackets.
That's why you
that
use
win, that's right. And you do it on a log scale too. The set of brackets that have possibility of winning is essentially 0% of all the total brackets.
And yet, there are many, many, many of them.
By the way, this is why, you know, picking a bracket to win is a thankless and useless exercise. You're never going to do that in terms of exactly. That's why I think there's a prize. It's not going to ever happen. Getting a perfect bracket is essentially a zero probability event, practically a zero probability event. That's why the grading of an NCAA tournament matters. Like, what's the scale? You need to know how many opponents you're dealing with and how many brackets you get to enter. So I have a paper with two of us, with Ryan Brill, and with one of our colleagues, Ian Barnett, where we actually tried to calculate what is the optimal way to play an NCAA tournament, where the parameters are the number of opponents and the free or independent parameters, how many entries you get to make on your own. And the basic idea is that you'll win if one of your entries is the highest scoring bracket among all the submissions. And that's the problem we
probably. Well, I would imagine, Adi, just to give the intuition, if I've got this right, but you're about to tell me I got it wrong, but I have a 50-50 chance of getting this right. The more competitors, the more I have to insert variants.
100%.
I got that right. Okay, so I got good intuition there.
Yeah, that's right. But of course, it also depends on how the competitors are playing, and you have to kind of have some inference on that. You can make a lot of money if your competitors are all chalky. If they just start with chalk and then throw in a few trinkets of upsets, you can crush them without very many.
Yeah, like for example, in my view, if I'm going to play a bracket pool for dollars, may or may not, I guarantee you I will not be picking UConn to win the title, which is everybody's heavy on favorite right now. They're the number one team. They're the defending national champion. I got to ask you guys this question since I ask this every year. I don't remember the last time someone won two in a row. It might be Duke back in the 90s. I don't even know when it is. But it's been a long time since someone's won back-to-back national titles. I always ask you guys this stupid question, but what the hell, I'll ask it again. How much does that change your probability? If I tell you that no one's won, Kate, I'm at least consistent. You tell me Connecticut's got a 2%, 5% chance to win the national title, and I say, oh, did I forget to tell you? No one's won back to back in like 30 plus years. How much does that move you off 5%? Adi's about to tell me zero.
It moves me.
Yeah,
zero.
I'm basically on it at zero as well. I mean, all that's already built into everything we know about the team, and I don't think it matters one extra bit of information. The fact that they won, although I tell you, when you talk to people who play the games, they say it matters a lot. So
that's why I bring it up every time.
Well, I don't, in basketball, it's college basketball these days, there's so much turnover on rosters from 1 year.
I had the next to last. The last one was Florida in 06 and 07. But before that, it was Duke in 91, 90. Okay. So one time in the last 32 years, and you two statistician types aren't moving your probability at all. All right. Well, I'm moving mine.
Okay, let's take Adi's idea and talk more practically, because most people aren't going to run the ex post likelihood that their bracket will work out. What advice do you have on things like, you know, one heuristic is the total sum of seeds that make the final four? These are some things that we can observe historical regularities about and kind of bound the possibilities reasonably, right? So we may not have that
Yeah.
at our fingertips. We've talked about a sum in the past, but that number is reasonably understood and reasonably bound.
I think what's most important, though, is the distribution of the four. So you get to the number where you get, and I understand, is it with three ones and twos and one eight? That is that how you get there? Or do you get there with distribution that's uniform on whatever the mean is divided by
Course, of
four?
course.
I don't, and it's tricky business because you are not playing the game that I'm describing. You are not doing the multi-brackets problem. You are doing the single or two or three bracket problem, and you cannot try to manufacture in your submission the characteristics that it would take to win in the multi-brackets problem. So I would not advocate going for a final four that has a sum of the ranks of the that's close to the average. I would definitely push that much closer to the lower end of that distribution.
Say more about that. What you're are you in the multi-bracket game or the single bracket game?
No, and not a, people are playing single. Nobody plays multi-bracket. I mean, you can have a few entries, but the genuine
Single
multi-bracket is when you enter
bracket,
tens of thousands of times into a tournament.
you're going to recommend going to a infrequently observed final four.
Yes, because your goal is not exact matching. Your goal is score maximizing.
Score maximizing. What does that mean here?
They have a scoring system that gives you points to how many correct picks you made in each round, and they tend to be very highly tilted towards the top.
Push me and Eric, help me out here. We're trying to work with an intuition for a casual player with a single bracket, and we've talked a lot about representativeness. I mean, whenever you talk about, calculating the ex post likelihood of your bracket and choosing it from the entropy space or whatever the heck, you're talking representative of what's reasonable. And set, but yet now, when we're going to the final four and the seeds that you're putting into the final four, you're saying, you want to not be representative.
No, because when you're dealing with single brackets or few entries and against tournaments that are not massive, and that's what very few people, if you're trying to enter, win the ESPN tournament with millions of people, then no, then you are going to want to make your picks close to the average of the sum of the ranks. Absolutely. But if you're just trying to win your home bracket with your best friends and your family, don't do that.
This is I'm still working for the intuition here because I'm with Eric earlier. Eric's like, the bigger the pool, the more variance you need,
That's
which
right. I just repeated that.
one dimension of the variance is how representative your final set of seeds is, your final four set of seeds is. Why are you telling me to be unrepresentative in my set of final four seeds if I'm in a normal smallish bracket with my friends? I thought that would be a low.
I'm unrepresentative only insofar as that the average might be, say, 12, or what's the average? I don't even know it. Do you know what the average is of the final four, the sum of the seeds?
Lower than 12, but yeah, let's call it nine.
Okay, nine. So I would not go for nine. I would go for something closer to four or five because I get so much value in getting a pick in the final two and the winner. And by
You're saying
promoting,
lower variance. Lower variance means more a chalkier final four. Okay.
that's right.
Wow. Okay. Good. Good. All right. Let's stop there. Now that we've settled a couple of things, let's stop there and change sports. Good stuff. Less. That's so depressing, actually. We work so hard to be capture variance and represent variance in our forecasts of the world. And in this case, you're saying for a normal friends and family pool, forget variance. Go a little chalkier, at least in the end,
Oh,
when you
yeah.
want to. That's interesting. Okay. All right. Let's change sports and talk about the NFL draft. It is NFL draft season. Getting closer and closer. By the way, we're coming up on Masters as well. I'm seeing Masters stuff being talked about. That's just around the corner. On the other side of that, another of our favorite events in April. It is a good month for sports, isn't it? We get opening day typically. We get the Masters. We get the NFL draft. Okay, NFL draft, fun year to talk quarterbacks. Even more fun than usual because we're watching the 2021 quarterback draft implode all over the league. And yet, we're still hyping the 2024 quarterback draft. So Eric asked this interesting question beforehand. How did he say it? He said, "What is the if we have five QBs expected to be drafted in the first round, how should we think about the expected number of successful picks of those five. Let's, you know it when you see it. Successful NFL quarterback, successful, lives up to the expectations of a first round pick. How many of those five should we expect to meet that expectation? Assuming we see five picked.
I was going to say facetiously three plus or minus two.
Well, even the mean variance, you're too high, right? There's no way the mean is three fifths.
No way. No way. No way. I would say I'm expecting
2 plus or minus 2.
You'd say 2 plus or minus. I think the mean is probably somewhere maybe a little higher than one and less than two. That's just my intuition. And I think that a great year would be three of them turning out to be great, and a nice regular normal year would be zero or one.
So let me ask you, McKinney, if you were I think it's the Chicago Bears, right? They have the one pick, and I forget if it's the 9, 10, whatever it is, or 13, whatever the other second number it is. Should they draft two quarterbacks?
I don't know if they should. I'm not opposed to the two quarterback strategy when you got one of the roster, but they just dealt their recent top draft quarterback.
Yeah, Justin Fields, right. So I'm just saying, would it be worth – I'm just commenting, since the probability is, I mean, again, you could view it as a waste. You'd rather draft in some other position. You don't want to put that much stock, but I would just,
I think you've got to stagger development and assessment phases more than that. I think it may be, there may be some inefficiency in having two guys you're trying to figure out at the exact same developmental stage. But that's just an intuition. Here's a related question. How often is the first quarterback drafted the best quarterback in that year's draft long term? How often does he prove to be the best quarterback in the draft? And I'll set the over under. And this is a these are noble questions we're asking. We just don't have the data in front of us. Maybe some of our productive listeners will run these and answer them for us. If not, we'll come up with data eventually. But what do you while you guys are mulling this, I'm gonna mull an over under. I'll try to set the market here. I'm gonna say at the over-under on the first pick of the draft, the first quarterback taken, wherever it is, being the best quarterback in that draft, I'm going to set that at 25%.
I was going to say either 25% or a third. So I was going to say one of those two numbers, definitely no higher. I will take the over.
I'm going with the under. That was obvious.
Love it.
I think that the number one quarterback is, I mean, well, you know, how many typically are there? It's hard to be much lower than that.
There might be 10 quarterbacks, 15 taken in the entire draft.
But the top ones really get the chance to be great with any frequency. I mean, obviously they're wonderful examples, but but by the time the career goes on, I mean, I would still go under, but not much under. I mean, can we just rattle them off from previous drafts? Where are we?
No, you can't. That's impossible. It'll be too inefficient. Someone will run the numbers for us, or we'll run them eventually. I like that question, though. But obviously, it should sober the fans, writers, and general managers who get too hyped about the first quarterback in the draft when you look at the hard, cold numbers of how often that guy is actually the best quarterback long term. What else you got on this broad area? Well, here's another probability number for you. Scottie Scheffler goes out and wins the Players this past weekend, and he won it last year. As Eric noted, that's the first time in the 50. This year was the 50th year they played that tournament. So this is, for those of the big golf fans, this is kind of the fifth major, if you will. It's not a major, but it's pretty much the most prestigious non-major golf tournament. And Scottie Scheffler goes out and wins it. First time ever to repeat as a player. And Eric asked the question, how long should we expect to wait for another repeat? Well, Eric's such a momentum guy. He's going to lock in Scottie Scheffler for his bets next year. Scottie's a lock, right? After two.
Well, I'll say the following. I do believe there are course-specific abilities in the sense that certain courses fit someone's game better than the other. And so I would, I'll ask you this question, and this one I don't think you'll say 0-1. Let's say I told you that next year Scottie Scheffler is a 5% chance to win the Players. And then I said, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you that he won the last 2 years. How much would you raise your probability then?
Well, I'm going to give you Audie's answer from the last time you asked it in this case. It's like, I think that number's in the market, and I'm going to relatively trust the market. But if you told me Scottie Scheffler was a baseline 5% to win any tournament with an average field that he entered, or with the field of comparable strength to the TPC that he entered. But this happens to be the TPC. I'd say, no, let's bump it up, because I agree with your course effects, your player course interactions.
Yeah. No, I
yeah,
think,
I think that's,
yeah,
I think that's true. I think one way to get one way to ask yourself, how long do we have to wait until this happens again? Basically starts with the question, what are the probabilities of the top player, the top five, the top 10? What are the cumulative probabilities of winning a tournament? And I think we generally argue that it's you need about six or seven or eight golfers to get to the 50% mark.
At least.
Right? In that,
at least.
So
making that argument in major golf tournaments where the fields are stronger. So maybe in an average tournament, it would be a smaller number. But
so I'm actually claiming that the 50 is a long wait. And that is that's why we're actually talking about it, because it hasn't happened. It's a selection bias observation. It's an interesting phenomenon because it shouldn't have gone this long. We should have had a back-to-back winner probably every 20 years is what I'm kind of guessing, because every tournament has a winner. And with decent probability, the winner is back the next year. And that winner is probably a pretty good golfer, and he probably has about a 5% chance of winning. Maybe it's 3%. That would say 5% is one in that's 20. So 3%, that's one of the best parts about the geometric distribution. It's time is just one over the probability. So, you know, each golfer who wins the previous year is about one. Yep.
I was going to ask you about that. And so do that again, if you would. Is there anything special or useful about wait times in the way we structure and think about wait times? If you know, I think you just all did it. Just be clear. The probability of an event happening is X or 5%, for example.
What Adi said, it's called a geometric distribution. It's a waiting time distribution. Think of there being a 5% coin flip for a given player on any given year. And then
the one last year is who it is. That's who that player is. Yeah.
Yeah, we know who the player is. And so the probability, I don't know, Adi. So we have to think about that. Do you think the probability of a repeat winner?
So whoever won last year, they're now in this year. Yep. What is their typical probability of winning the tournament? And that's what I asked. You generally imagine it's probably a good golfer in a not a great field. So is 5% about right? Is it 3%? I would argue it's not 2% on average, which is 1 in 50, which is a 50-year wait.
Right.
But I don't have enough knowledge, so I'm deferring to you experts on golf tournament analysis to know. I'm just using the Masters, I mean the majors, which we go about 7 or 8 to get 50%. So the best golfer is about 8% probability, and the next one down to 6, and these are top ones.
I think it's also another way to norm it, as you said, Adi, is to look at other major tournaments. Like there have been back-to-back winners in the U.S. Open. As a matter of fact, there have been back-to-back winners in the Masters. There's been back-to-back winners of the British. I don't know if there's been a back-to-back winner of the PGA. Maybe Tiger did it in the early 2000s. But
That's less common there?
Say it again?
You know why it's less common in the PGA Championship? There's a very parsimonious explanation for that.
There's more players that play it.
Much bigger field. Much bigger,
bigger field. Bigger field. The Masters is like 70 people, and the PGA is like double the size.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
All right, guys. Last statistical question / current event discussion of the week. Alcaraz wins Indian Wells. So, Eric, is it fair to think about Indian Wells as kind of the TPC of the tennis tour, that it's just off the major? It's one of the more prestigious non-major tournaments?
It's one of the prestigious non-major hard court tournaments. There would be other Masters 1000 on clay, like the Monte Carlo or the Rome Masters. There would be, you know, one on grass, maybe the, you know, I forget the name of the tournament that's played on grass. But yes, it would be considered just outside the major.
I'm totally going with it's the TPC of the tennis tour.
It's the TPC. There it is.
Alcaraz wins this thing. And Eric is saying that experts say, and I hope he's not quoting himself, experts say when he plays his absolute best, he'll beat everyone. So this is interesting to me, because how would you think about that and how would you model that?
Well, I can tell you, I'm looking at, there's a great website, tennisabstract.com. It's got the ELO ratings for all the current players, by the way. Just so you know, on grass and clay, Alcaraz is ranked number one. On hard courts, Jannik Sinner is ranked number one. At least as of right now, Novak Djokovic is not number one on any surface. But just to let you know, the peak Elo rating it has for Alcaraz, he hasn't played for that long, is 200 points below the peak Elo rating of Djokovic. And according to this, that implies that in his peak, Djokovic would have had about a three-quarter probability of beating Sinner. So if people, sorry, Alcaraz. So if people think Alcaraz would beat anybody in their greatest right now, it implies that they think the whole level of play has gone down because the Djokovic's, the Nadal's, and the Federer's have all had peak Elo ratings in the 2400 range, and they have Sinner and Alcaraz at about in the 20 low 2200s, which means that they just think that they're not as great as the greats, and that's probably true.
Totally reasonable. I took the question to be slightly different, and I think perhaps more interesting, and that is when he plays his best on any given day, that's going to be anybody that he plays. And so the Elo ratings are expected performance at a moment in time. But when a person walks out on the court, you're going to get a draw from a distribution on that day. Around that Elo mean, you're going to have some permutation up or down. And that's the within player variance we've talked about a lot on the show. We hit on our 10-year anniversary. And my read of that question was, oh, you're saying Alcaraz, when you get that draw from the right tail of his distribution, he's not losing to anybody right now. And I think that's an interesting question.
Yeah, I found, and the two people that said it, just for the record, were Jim Courier and Martina Navratilova. So their comment was, if he's playing at his peak right now, he's going to win. I just thought it was an interesting comment, and you're right. It's a comment about the right tail of the distribution. When he's drawing from his extreme right tail, they think he's not beatable right now.
Have there been other eras? So one of the reasons he's not beatable is because, as you said, the competition around him is not as strong as it used to be. Have there been eras when they're like equally good players, but one of them has a more prominent right tail than the others?
Serena Williams, Steffi Graf, Martina Navratilova. We could make an argument Bjorn Borg in the late 70s, Pete Sampras at his peak. And the problem with you can't say the big three because they were all playing at the same time.
Okay, super interesting. Good fun. Well, Alcaraz is still coming, apparently. All right, guys, that has been our show for the week. That has been a full hour of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. For the whole crew here, Eric Bradlow and Audie Weiner, who've been with me from the start this week, Shane Jensen in absentia, he'll be back. Matty Datz, the boss man, along for the ride. Dion Simpkins doing all of the work to make this thing happen. Many thanks to Matty and Dion. And to Kelly, the intern, really appreciate the work and the help. Appreciate you guys listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.